loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA, have agreed to stay in it with Iran and will resist the U.S. calls to sanction Iranian oil sales. However, Iran warned its fellow signatories that they would need to work on concrete solutions rather than on, quote, lofty and obscure promises, unquote. Next, in the face of international condemnation and on-the-ground resistance, an Israeli high court froze the planned demolition of the West Bank Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar late last night. We'll take a look at this struggle and the reality of life under the occupation. Then, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Pyongyang this morning for talks with North Korean officials, his third trip in 3 months. Pompeo was greeted by top-ranking DPRK officials and is expected to push denuclearization talks forward, and the White House has laid out 3 scenarios for success, one in 6 months, one in a year, and one by the end of President Trump's term. And then, do kids have the right to a decent education? A U.S. District Court judge in Michigan ruled that they do not. In response to a class action lawsuit alleging that underfunding and racism in Detroit schools have done tremendous harm to the city's children. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, have agreed to stay in it with Iran and will resist the U.S. calls to sanction Iran's oil sales. However, Iran warned its fellow signatories that they would need to work on concrete solutions rather than, quote, lofty and obscure promises, unquote. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Masoud, we've talked about this on the show a couple of times, and I think that we really don't know what this means yet. It's been only speculation. You've got the United States, which is the 800-pound gorilla of the room, and then you have its allies, which really do want to continue doing business with Iran. The JCPOA lays out the method by which the rest of the world can do business with Iran, and now the Trump administration has tried to kill it. So what happens next when you have what looks to be the United States now pitting itself against its own allies?
Yeah, it's a very bizarre situation. I mean, the reality is everyone with any common sense agrees that this is a good deal. It guarantees the fact that Iran will not go towards nuclear weapons, and is a deal that is win-win situation. But Trump took a position and became the bully of the international community. And now, as you said very clearly, the rest of the international community recognize that this is a good solution, recognizing that this is a win-win for everyone, recognizing that this is the best way of keeping some level of tranquility and peace in the region. And they want to hold on to it. But what the question comes with this but, they're not really sure what they're willing to, how far they're willing to pay for doing so. And they're wary of the bully of the international community. And there are some observers who are saying that, publicly and openly, they're saying they're standing by the deal. But are they really going to be in a position to take a stand to guarantee Iran that the deal is intact, and indeed Iran will benefit from that deal? Or is it just going to be lip service saying that we are going to recognize this deal but don't deliver anything because they're worried and they're scared of US and Trump? And if that's the case, then this deal obviously is not going to go anywhere. And the reality is that there is no halfway. Either this deal is going to be honored or this deal is not going to be honored. And I think, you know, we can't sort of have a lip service honoring the deal. And then in practice, the deal is basically just a lip service and a commitment from Iran not to sort of to make all its commitment, but the international community either not willing or not able to deliver its sort of share of the deal. And I think that is the really the question currently, and the warnings that we are hearing from President Rouhani seems that this matter has not been fully resolved yet.
Yeah, that's why Iran is saying, yeah, nice to make promises, but we need more than lofty and obscure promises. They need to be practical, specific. What will the European countries, it's the P5 plus one, which means the Security Council countries plus Germany and Iran, and what are they going to specifically do now because the quid pro quo was Iran will not continue to expand uranium enrichment. It will have all sorts of intrusive inspections, and in exchange, it will have economic relief from sanctions. Sanctions will be lifted. Business will be conducted. Trade, there will be trade going back and forth between Iran and the other signatory countries. If those countries say they want to keep it, but they're not willing to give Iran guarantees about this, then it's off. It's going to be off.
Yeah, of course it's going to be off. I mean, the reality is you can't expect Iran to hold on to its commitment 100% while the international community just want to do lip service. I mean, the reality is that, you know, if there is a matter of just lip service, then both sides could do lip service. You know, Iran would not deliver anything except talking about goodwill. And then sort of European and European community and Russia and China would also not deliver anything and just give lip service, which really it basically means is off. I mean, what we can't have is full commitment, practical and physical commitment by Iran, and then lip service from the other side. And I mean, this is just not going to happen. I mean, it won't happen. And it will not be tolerated by the Iranians. And the fact of the matter is, Mr. Rouhani made a very important and fundamental sort of a statement that if Iran is not going to be able to sell oil, then what guarantee is that anybody else is going to be able to?
Meaning, okay, let's talk about that. Does that mean, for instance, Iran possibly taking action to close the Strait of Hormuz, through which a great number of oil tankers come? Or, I mean, what's their leverage here? What can they do?
I think Iran has got number of options. One sort of avenue is to resume nuclear activities. And then the other side is not to resume, but enforce its sort of right in the region economically against a one-sided boycott by U.S., which is not recognized internationally, is not recognized by anyone else, and say that if you are going to sort of use your physical power to boycott us and to sort of damage us economically, then we're going to use our physical power and our sort of advantage, i.e. Strait of Hormuz, to do the same thing against your economical interest. And I think, you know, there is a lot of sort of sympathy for that, both inside Iran and probably elsewhere outside Iran as well.
Masoud, let me just jump in again, because we only have a couple minutes left. I think these are super important issues, because one, what would Iran do to make passage through the Strait of Hormuz more difficult for oil tankers? Obviously, that's a strategic point of leverage. And secondly, if they were to do it, and undoubtedly all of these calculations are being considered together, Would that then be used by the hawks in the Trump administration to say, okay, Iran is now an international outlaw, pariah, physically obstructing trade, and we will take military action against them? What are your take? What's your take on both those things?
I mean, the fact of the matter is Iran has got certain ability, and anyone who knows the region and knows the state of Hormuz, it's a very, very narrow way and is not that difficult to stop it. At the time of Iran-Iraq war, Iran was having sort of inspecting any ship that went through, be it going to Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or Iraq or anywhere else. And they could start that sort of thing. I mean, as I said, there is two options: reintroducing sort of activity on nuclear, or sort of enforcing and using their ability, geographical and political, economical ability to enforce their sort of right of to sort of international market. And I think, you know, when you look at it, I think the second option is much better, because, you know, it shows in same time that Iran is willing to stand up for itself, but it also shows Iran is not interested in becoming a nuclear power. But Iran wants to ensure its economical and political rights in the region, like any other independent state does. And as regards hawks are going to take any action by Iran as a negativity. The fact of the matter is that they even taken this deal as a negative sort of thing. So, you know, really, there is no winning with the hawks of the U.S. They seem to be set their mind into sort of escalating the conflict and creating conflict. But I think the ball is in the sort of the rest of the international community. Are they really going to make any action? I mean, they all recognize that this is madness, what Trump has done and the U.S. has done. They realize that, but are they going to really try to resolve this, or are they going to just sit on the fence?
Yeah, and I want to encourage people to look at the map for the Middle East. You have the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, which is a very narrow strait, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, Iran, all of these countries, these oil exporting countries, are right there to get oil tankers through there. If there's any sort of obstruction, you can see how oil supplies would back up right away. Anyway, John, we're going to keep following this because this is going to be perhaps the pivot of international politics.
That's right. We were joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In the face of international condemnation and on-the-ground resistance, an Israeli high court froze the planned demolition of the West Bank Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar late last night. We will take a look at this struggle and the reality of life under the Israeli occupation. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Ali, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Ali, I have to say that I was surprised by this Israeli court decision. I just expected that with precedent, the way we've seen it over the generations, that Palestinians really don't have very much in the way of rights. What happened in this case?
Well, don't hold your breath. There is a temporary stay from the High Court against this demolition. But I think it's very much for show, because in May, the High Court cleared the way for the total destruction of Khan al-Ahmar, despite years of efforts by the residents to save the village, and the fact that this demolition is completely illegal under international law, no matter what the Israeli High Court says. What operates here is international law, particularly the Fourth Geneva Convention, because this is an occupied territory. Under the Fourth Geneva Convention, an occupying power, in this case Israel, only has the power to move people if it is for military necessity. In this case, as in many other cases of villages across the West Bank that are similarly threatened, the reason that that Israel plans to force the people of Khan al-Ahmar off their village and off their land is in order to steal the land from them and to give it to Jewish settlers. So this is explicitly for colonial expansion, and forcible transfer in that context is a war crime. And that's what Israeli, Palestinian, international human rights groups and UN officials and experts have been saying for years and years.
Ali, I'm looking at the pictures right now. I'm actually on RT's website. It's a picture of all of these people standing in front of the bulldozer, and then behind them are armed soldiers. Let's just talk about the resistance. I mean, it's against all odds, and yet people keep resisting.
What choice do they have? The people of Khan al-Ahmar, if the ethnic cleansing goes ahead, will be forced to go and live near a garbage dump in an area near the Palestinian village of Abu Dis. And this land that they're living on, they've been living on it for more than 60 years after having been ethnically cleansed from their previous traditional land. So you have no choice but to resist, because Israel will continue to pursue you and chase you off your land until it's taken all of it. Let's step back and look at the bigger picture here. Khan al-Ahmar is one of a number of communities in what is called Area C. What's that? Area C is 60% of the occupied West Bank, where Israel retains full military control under the terms of the 1993 Oslo agreements. So the vast majority of the West Bank is under full Israeli military control. Another 20% is under Israeli military control and supposedly Palestinian Authority civil rule. And then just a little tiny fraction is under full Palestinian Authority control, where, you know, that Israel can still barge in anytime it wants to. So that's the overall context. And what's been going on over a number of years since these so-called peace agreements were signed is that Israel is determined to annex Area C. And so it has been moving against communities like Khan al-Ahmar over time as kind of a salami slicing technique. You take a little bit here, you take a little bit there. The international community will issue a little protest, but they'll forget and they won't do anything. Then you move on to the next village. And that has been Israel's strategy to annex Area C. And much of the Israeli government believes that Area C should be annexed outright to the State of Israel. And that really seems to be the direction the Trump administration is pushing as well, that the Palestinians, if they get something called a state, it will be in only the tiny fractions of the West Bank where the Palestinian Authority rules. So that also helps explain why Khan al-Ahmar is getting comparatively a large amount of attention from the so-called international community. We've seen the European Union and the UN and various governments speaking out against this. We even saw last year 10 U.S. senators, including Dianne Feinstein, signing a letter saying that the residents of Khan al-Ahmar should not be forced off their land. The reason for that concern is not so much a humanitarian concern for the people of Khan al-Ahmar, but because those international powers understand this move against Khan al-Ahmar as part of the bigger Israeli land grab, which is designed to foreclose once and for all on the two-state solution. And Khan al-Ahmar and Abu Nuwar, another community that is under imminent threat, are in a strategic area east of Jerusalem that Israel plans to expand its settlements into, an area that is known in technical jargon as E1. And if Israel builds the settlement in E1, that will irrevocably divide the West Bank from north to south. In other words, it makes any kind of contiguity for an envisioned Palestinian state completely impossible.
We are speaking with Ali Abu Nima. Ali is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. We're talking about Palestine, and we're talking about a court decision late last night regarding the planned demolition of the West Bank Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar. Ali, tell me, is this decision specific to Khan al-Ahmar, or does it have something to do with really the whole of Palestine? Is there anything that we can look forward to with this decision being temporary the way it is?
No, I don't think it's in any way precedent setting or portends anything better. As far as I've read, it's simply a temporary stay for a few days that is local. I suspect that it's simply to try to get the international media attention off this story, because there has been a lot on it. But the important thing to remember about the Israeli court, is, including the High Court, is that they have systematically blessed and approved of every crime that Israel has committed against the Palestinian people under international law. They have blessed torture. They have blessed punitive home demolitions. The court, as I mentioned, in May, in fact, gave its final approval to the forcible expulsion of the people of Khan al-Ahmar. So there should be no expectation whatsoever. We have to be very clear about this. No expectation whatsoever that the Israeli High Court or Israeli judiciary is in any way a check on Israel's power. I mean, how could it be that after decades and decades of the Israeli Supreme Court looking at these things, that there are 600,000 settlers in the West Bank? The court is simply a fig leaf. And also, it's important to note that just earlier, in fact, in June, just last month, the Israeli military issued new military orders affecting Palestinians in the West Bank to make it even easier for the army to destroy Palestinian homes and seize land. Previously, under Israeli military orders, they would issue demolition orders for each individual building. And what Israel started doing recently was issuing basically collective demolition orders for an entire village at once. That's what's going on in the background. And of course, these are all fig leaf proceedings, because the reality is Palestinians have no real due process or no real chance of winning in the Israeli courts. All of this procedure is a fig leaf, so that at the end of the day, Israel can say to its own people or to international observers, well, we're just following the law. Everything Israel has done to the Palestinians is legal under Israeli law. The problem is, it is completely illegal and criminal and amounts to war crimes under international law, but because of the impunity Israel enjoys internationally, nothing is being done to stop it.
That's the voice of Ali Abu Nima. Ali, as you mentioned, and I want to read for our audience again, Article 53 of the Fourth Geneva Conventions about the responsibilities and rules, laws regarding occupying powers. Any destruction by the occupying power of real or personal property belonging individually or collectively to private persons or to the state or to other public authorities or to social or cooperative organizations is prohibited, except where such destruction is rendered absolutely necessary by military operations. So international law is crystal clear. There's other international laws and other laws that pertain. You mentioned this is the Trump plan, or perhaps Trump ratifying the Israeli plan. Where do you think Trump wants to end? What's the end goal here? We have about 60 seconds.
The end goal is to liquidate the Palestinian cause once and for all, for Israel to win, and for that Israeli victory to be ratified with something called a peace deal or the deal of the century, in which Palestinians surrender. And if they want to call that surrender peace, or if they want to call it a state, that will be, you know, Trump and company will be very happy to let them do that. But their vision is for an Israeli victory. David Friedman, the bankruptcy lawyer who is Trump's ambassador in Israel, was quoted recently as saying that the deal of the century will be a bankruptcy-type deal for the Palestinians. That is what they have in mind. And that's why Palestinians and their allies around the world have no choice but to resist, to protest, to boycott, to divest, to sanction. It's the only hope Palestinians have.
We will have to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Ali Abu Nima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Pyongyang this morning for talks with North Korean officials, his third trip in 3 months. Pompeo was greeted by top-ranking DPRK officials and is expected to push denuclearization talks forward. And the White House has laid out 3 scenarios for success, one in 6 months, one in a year, and one by the end of President Trump's term. We're joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Simone, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me again.
Simone, tell us, what realistically should we expect from this Pompeo trip? Have the preliminaries already been negotiated and he's there just to tie up loose ends? Or do we still have a long way to go on a real agreement on something?
I think we still have a long way to go, but I think that this is an important visit. As you know, this is the second, I believe, visit of by the secretary, now the Secretary of State Pompeo. And this is obviously the first high-level of visit after the Singapore summit. And from the airport, I saw the images where secretary was received very warmly by DPI. Outcase the foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, and also vice chairman, Kim Jong-un, the second man, Kim Yong-chul. And they, so far they had about 2 hours and 45 minutes talk, and details aren't provided yet, but it looks like the meeting is going very well. And also second meeting is scheduled. And there's a likelihood that Secretary Pompeo might meet with Kim Jong-un if all goes well. So that's what's going on. So far, so good. As one professor at Yonsei University said that, so looks like a negotiation is being handled by very smart and capable and serious people. So we should have, we should be stay pretty optimistic. And I think with regard to the scenario, I believe that the third scenario where we're going to probably, they're going to work on the rather midterm, long-term goal, step by step, which means that within, you know, time frame of from 6 months to 2 year, which is long, but I think that by within 2 years time framework, I think we're going to see what now the new term that United States using, the final fully verifiable denuclearization instead of CVID. And so that's, I think, so we are in all, I think we should feel pretty, optimistic. And more importantly, I think this visit also shows that, you know, we are witnessing what for the first time in quite, you know, in long years. And we're looking at, what diplomacy look like. Diplomacy means that you're going step by step and a negotiation process. And that's what we're looking at. And the one more thing I think we should also probably pay attention to is, as you know, there has been some sort of what even many serious analysts call the official attempt to sabotage further North Korea talks. Mm-hmm. As you recall, those, you know, the intelligence leaked to NBC and the Washington Post just last week, and there's this whole, you know, this dozen of American officials talking about how North Korea can't be trusted, and North Korea is in fact increasing its nuclear production facilities, et cetera, with the kind of sabotage attempt that we have seen actually for more than, 15 years. So here we go again. So in a way, the Pompeo's visit is a very timely. I don't think he probably they scheduled a long time ago before this latest sort of sabotage, you know, attempt broke. And so, so I think going back to your answering your question, we are most likely to see again more confidence building and have us, if all goes well, some more concrete timeline, which then can obviously address some of those concerns, critics.
Professor Simone Chun is our guest. We're talking to Professor Chun from Seattle about the visit of Mike Pompeo to North Korea. There's different parts of this, as you mentioned, Professor Chun. There's so much sabotage, like the media, Washington Post, New York Times, CNN. It's as if something terrible has just happened or is about to, because peace talks are underway. You know, when I think back to the early years of the Reagan administration, liberal people in general were demanding, when Reagan was modernizing the nuclear U.S. nuclear weapon systems and putting new missiles in place, which is exactly what's happening right now. The U.S. is modernizing its nuclear weapons program to a tune of $1 trillion in violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. But in the early years of the Reagan administration, I went to lots of demonstrations with lots of liberal people and progressive people who said the U.S. must live up to the NPT and start getting rid of its nuclear weapons. And now those demands are not coming against the U.S. at all. All the demands are about North Korea, or the skepticism about North Korea, or North Korea can't be trusted. It's kind of a role reversal. So kind of a bleak situation for progressives, not all progressives. Certainly there are many genuine progressives who know that this is a good thing. That's one piece of this. The other piece is what's going on in Korea. I'm looking at a headline and pictures of the two Koreas playing basketball together before vast audiences in this giant auditorium in Seoul, women's basketball, men's basketball, and the two Koreas are playing not just against each other, but they have intermingled teams. So we have the other dynamic of what Koreans are doing, what the Korean people are doing, and what they're thinking and feeling. And that's a central, I would say, the central dynamic here. Anyway, go ahead.
Yes, I think that that's very true. Actually, you have what we are almost every day these days. The inter-Korean talks is basically following up the Panmunjom Declaration step by step, and so there's the unification basketball game, and now the Koreans gonna have a Northern inter-Korean a joint theater group that's going to perform in Pyongyang and also in Seoul. And so it's like I'm even having a very hard time to keeping up with all this, you know, flurry of inter-Korean engagement. And so, as you know, it's very, as I think we don't have to repeat again, is the more than 80%, you know, overwhelming Koreans support it. And then when I went to Korea in May, and it was so obvious. And one thing I want to mention to you is that, you know, this was the first time I went to Korea in 3 years. And I was blown away by the way the Korean, the amazing job the Korean media is doing and covering this current peace process. And very in-depth, you know, they have, even on Saturday, I saw there's the JTV show, but almost 2 hours, they have an expert who is basically very serious analysis. And now I finally understand why Koreans have such overwhelming support for the current peace process. They're getting the good, really, in a professional, more accurate analysis, whereas in the United States, where you have all this corporate media from,
totally,
you know, even reputable, Washington Post, NBC, they all have it's almost like it's worse than, in a way, it's a totalitarian media. You have only one talking point and everybody's following. And I was last week when all the sabotage sort of leak, I would say sabotage gate was coming out, I was at the gym briefly. Oh my God, it was shocking. All over, within half an hour, there was CNN everywhere. They're all talking about how North Korea is increasing, you know, the nuclear production facility. So I think that the main, one of the biggest obstacle, I would say at this point, is actually the either established security analysts against the corporate media, which is also, and also the, unfortunately, you know, I was supporting Democrat, you know, progress Democrat, but this time I was, I'm just appalled by this lack of support in the Democratic Congress. And in fact, you know, right after the summit, and I mentioned to you, I visited six Democratic senators' offices, and I met with their advisors. I mean, they were, it was just appalling. They were, it was literally the next day. They were already had a script. They were ready to say, because there's nothing in it, it was worse than the previous agreement, and there's no concrete. And they were, I was very, very, you know, it was shocked. So I think we have a liberal media who is also, is very part of this, I don't know if it's a conspiracy, but definitely not supporting it. And so, and also within the Congress as well. But I think it's a, but I think the good news is that, you know, the, in a way, it's American, it's a, still, it's a presidential system. I think it looks like Trump has his sort of personal really interest and passion in this particular issue. And there's, as you guys know, that, you know, 55% approval rating or support for the, this particular policy on North Korea. So I think that we should, those, yeah, I think it, we are still on the right direction. But, and also one more thing I want to mention is that even American, as you know, there's a very, we have very strong peace movement. And also Korean Americans are very energized. Right now there is a former unification, Jung Se-yeon, former unification minister, is making tour of going around all these major cities in United States and Canada. Mm. He was here in Seattle yesterday.
That's important.
And I mean, this, yes, this, the minister has been in politics basically all his life, and specifically, you know, actually involved in the inter-Korean process. And, you know, Koreans, 300, 500, 1,000 Koreans showing up, you know. And so he was the basically, you know, the guy, he's like almost, you know, 80 years old, and he was giving 3 or 4 hours lectures. And so you can see the main point is that for Koreans, we think that this is in a way very, it's exciting, and it's led by two Koreans. And no matter, in a way, no matter what the United States or American public or, you know, the opposition within Congress, I think that I think this time the two Koreans are very, very committed. I think that as a secretary, the former secretary, Defense Secretary Perry wrote in this very excellent article, and, you know, truly this is the President Moon Jae-in's initiative, and that the entire Korea is behind it, so which is going to be a driving force.
John, whenever anything really historic happens, there's historic opposition because people don't, some sectors don't want change. That doesn't mean it won't happen. There's a lot of momentum here.
That's right. And then the wrong side looks terrible in history.
Yep.
Well, we're out of time. We were joined from Seattle by Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Do kids have the right to a decent education? Believe it or not, a U.S. District Court judge in Michigan ruled that they do not, in response to a class action lawsuit alleging that underfunding and racism in Detroit schools have done tremendous harm to the city's children. We're joined from Detroit by Nina Chacker. She is an activist and a Detroit public school teacher. Nina, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Nina, when I saw the headline to this story this morning, I was stunned by it, and I actually thought that I had read it incorrectly, and I went back to read it again. Can you explain to our listeners what this is about?
And it's the New York Times.
Yeah, no less.
Access to literacy, in quotes, is not a constitutional right.
Exactly.
Judge in Detroit rules. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Nina.
Right. I can't necessarily explain their thinking to you, but I wish I was more stunned by the outcome of it. They essentially determined that that wasn't something that was within the state's purview to provide to our children.
And what's the basis for the class action lawsuit?
Well, we've known for a long time that our students are coming out of our schools unprepared, and we also have been able to identify a lot of different factors within the schools and within our jobs that would help us to be able to give children access to literacy, but they've mostly fallen on deaf ears. So we've been fighting to change the conditions of the school without really getting to where we feel like we need to be, and they've at this point determined that that's not really their problem.
in the article in the Times, it says, on Friday, a federal district court judge in Michigan decided that they, the students, did not have this right to a better education when he dismissed a class action lawsuit filed by students at troubled schools in Detroit. Talk about conditions in Detroit.
There's a lot of variety within the district, but the reality is that a lot of students are working in buildings that are falling apart. They're in classes that are overcrowded. We don't have the same access to ancillary services that our students really depend on. And our students are already coming in a lot of the time with different types of baggage or distractions that are getting in their way of being able to learn how to perform these basic skills.
Yeah. And talk about the composition. Who are the students in Detroit?
So, you know, it's, of course, a very high poverty area, and most of our students are depending on schools for meals. They're almost entirely people of color. They're, you know, we're definitely dealing with a really high risk population that that needs the most support they can possibly get at school.
We have a phenomena in the Trump administration whereby the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, is really going out of her way to privatize public education, to take advantages of the weaknesses in public education, to make the argument that students and families should have choice. But that really means redirecting public money, taxpayers' money, to private, profit-driven charter schools. And it's also has the certainly the impact, we can see this throughout the South, in particular, of resegregating or making possible the sort of formal resegregation of Georgian schools, even in school districts that are still under Department of Justice court order about desegregation. Let's talk about what's happening in Detroit. Obviously, if there's a weakness in public education, the charter school movement will be there to say, look, it's failing. It has to fail. The only solution is privatization. Is that a factor going on in Detroit?
I think that's a huge factor. And, you know, it is very easy to scapegoat Betsy DeVos and Donald Trump at this point. But the reality is that the stage was completely set for him. This has been going on for decades. This is nothing new. We've been seeing this trend in Detroit for a long time. And the privatization of education has had the opposite impact on our kids. It's, if anything, providing them with way fewer options and way fewer high quality options than what they once had.
Yeah. And also Detroit, and I don't know, I think other parts of Michigan, certainly Flint, were under emergency financial control board. So even the semblance of democracy is in some ways has been sort of eviscerated as big banks vis-a-vis these emergency management instruments take over. Is that what's the situation like that for that in Detroit?
Yeah, absolutely. The fact that the state would rule that it's not not their responsibility, or that students don't have a right to literacy at this point, is even more egregious given that we've been under state control for all this time. So it's kind of a way for them to admit that they didn't really have the intention of helping our students get to the standards that we want to see them at while we were under emergency management. So we just got out of a long reign of emergency managers that really exacerbated all the problems that they had been brought in there to fix in the first place. They had been, you know, we were told that they were going to get us out of debt, that they were going to increase student productivity, that we were going to see a raise in like all the skills that we wanted our students to have. And of course, everything got a lot worse, and then they walked away.
Yeah. Let's talk to where this goes next. I mean, is there a legal recourse for the class action suit? It's been dismissed. Does it go to appeal? Does it go to the Court of Appeals? Or has the legal channel been basically shut down? And that's one question. And the second question that I have is for Nina is, you know, around the country right now, we have a new kind of revitalization of the labor movement vis-a-vis all of the teacher strikes and West Virginia, in Oklahoma, in Arizona, in what were traditionally Republican-dominated states, right-to-work states. Nonetheless, the teachers, because of the dire conditions that they face and that their students face, they've become in many ways sort of a vanguard for both the labor movement and for a community labor resurgence. What's going on with that, with the union movement and with the teachers union in Detroit, if you would?
You know, we're in sort of a different phase over here. So I think as far as the lawsuit goes, they have stated in no uncertain terms that they intend to appeal it. And I'm glad that they're going to go ahead and do that, because it is just such an outrageous claim that our students don't deserve a right to literacy. As far as the wider movement of teachers goes, it's been very exciting. I think that for us in Detroit right now, we're in a little bit of a different spot. We recently, you know, finally were taken out of emergency management's control. We still do have some issues with the structure and like a lack of a real real democracy that we can depend on. We still have some things in place that might block our elected board from being able to make decisions in our best interest. But we are finally, you know, we have a superintendent in our schools who has a little bit more say in what's going on. So we're waiting to see what happens with that. But it, a few years ago, we were doing a lot of sick outs. We were coordinating with teachers to bring attention to some of the same issues that were covered in the lawsuit. So we had our own wave of that, and now we're readjusting to a new situation and figuring out what strategies are going to be necessary for us to really fight for the education that our kids need as we move forward.
It's a very important cause and struggle. We wish you the very, very best. Real quick before we go out, what grade do you teach?
I'm a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing, and I teach elementary grades.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your work. John, I think we're out of time.
We are. We were joined from Detroit by Nina Chacker. Nina is an activist and a Detroit public school teacher. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines.
Joining us, some of the funniest, John.
You know, we really should say that because I think most of these are funny.
Yes.
Yeah. And the funny ones. So joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area, Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we're joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Russell. Welcome back.
Can I just establish the ground rules again? Steve, when we talk about funny headlines, don't tell us why they're funny.
Okay. Can I tell you that they are funny?
Go ahead. Let's start.
Okay. Let's start with this one, which appeared yesterday from The Hill. Trump compares border enforcement to keeping people off your front lawn.
So Wait a second. That's not funny. That's disgusting. That's supposed to be in the disgusting headlines category.
Although picturing Trump as a grumpy old man screaming at the kids to get off his lawn is a funny thing in
it's
your
not
head.
Really a even stretch, actually. He is a grumpy old man screaming
okay,
at people to get
the
off
thing.
His
lawn. When grumpy old people on your block yell at you and tell you to get off the lawn, they don't then grab you and put you in a cage and separate you from the rest of your family.
That is true. Although here in D.C., we have a lot of white people calling the cops on black people for just existing, and then they get put in cages.
Or in some of these cases, the white people are being called out by their neighbors, coworkers, and friends because it is such a disgusting thing. And again, too, that wouldn't be happening. I mean, that happens because racism is such a big part of America. But it's really happening because Donald Trump is telling all the white racists, it's okay to be openly white racist now. And
exactly.
I mean, that's the coded language, I think, from the administration. And so you have, like, we just, John, before, this isn't about headlines, but we were watching the video where you were about this woman yelling at a Mexican workers on a bus yelling, get out of my country and stuff like that.
Where are your papers?
Yeah. I mean, anyway, disgusting level of white supremacy and racism, the flames of which are being fanned. Mm-hmm. What about the second headline, Stephen, the funny column?
Well, this is from the Washington Examiner, and I'm absolutely positive they do not think it was funny, but I think probably most of us probably do, and the headline reads as follows, college grads less likely to be proud to be American.
Now, this piece goes on to say that that's because college campuses are very anti-American now, but I think it's maybe because people in college learn a little something about history and our particular brand of terrible imperialist history.
Well, yeah. Is that what the article says?
Yeah.
Yes.
It says that campuses are anti-American now.
Okay. College grads less likely to be proud to be American. I mean, I don't even know what it means to be proud to be an American. I mean, you know, when I used to pass out flyers as a 16-year-old against the war in Vietnam, people would yell, "Go back to Russia." Which, you know, as a 16-year-old, that always perplexed me. I didn't really get it. But what does it mean to be a proud American? That you're, you know, you salute the flag, put your hand on your heart, and don't question authority. Mm-hmm. And if the country goes to war, including illegal wars, wars of aggression like the war in Vietnam, wars that kill millions of people, you're supposed to, a proud American goes along with that? I don't know. What is a proud American, Nicole?
That is a great question. I was just thinking, too, about how the Pledge of Allegiance also, of course, says under God, which not all of us believe in, but we are supposed to say that we do.
But, you know, the under God part of the Pledge of Allegiance was put in the 1950s. So
I did not know that.
So members of the Communist Party wouldn't say it at their branch meetings. It wasn't before 1954 that we had under God.
That's a relatively recent development.
That's crazy.
Anyway, Donald Trump wants to do what to the United States?
Well, speaking of history, according to the Washington Post, actually a column, an op-ed column from Max Boot, Donald Trump wants to Finlandize the United States.
Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that.
Well, this is the history you learn in college when you become anti-American.
That's right.
According to the definition in this column says, Finlandization is the process whereby a country is induced to favor the interests of a more powerful country. So, just like Finland sort of subsumed its politics to that of Russia, we're supposed to assume that United States is going to subsume its politics to Russia because Russia is the more powerful country than the United States. I mean,
I think this headline should have fallen into another category, a category that we haven't yet created. The category would be headlines that no one except the author will possibly understand.
I think that's a pretty great category, Brian.
Yeah, that's it. Headlines that no one will get.
That's great.
Okay, let's go to some, not that those were that funny, but let's go to some disgusting headlines.
Okay, let's go to the most disgusting headline of the week, which again is an op-ed from the Washington Post, and it reads, "We already gave Syria, I'll repeat the word we already gave Syria to Putin, so what's left for Trump to say?" So here we have the latest chapter in the saga, in the Who Lost China saga that started 70 years ago. We have to decide, you know, who lost some country, as if Syria was, quote unquote, ours to give to anyone. And what amused me was we didn't give Syria to Russia, but we gave it to Putin personally. So apparently when he retires, he can, you know, put that in his Swiss bank account or something.
Maybe he'll set up like a luxury golf course.
Yeah.
That could be nice.
Condos.
That's right.
Exactly. Interestingly enough, the original headline, people may know that you can sometimes discern the original headline of an article from the URL or from the thumbnail, which appears if you post the article or someone else posts the article on Facebook or Twitter.
That's good to know.
And the original headline of this article read, "Both Obama and Trump let Putin have his way in Syria." So it's kind of interesting. Why was the headline changed? I think, you know, some editor looked and said, "Well, we don't want to blame Obama for things, so let's keep the focus on Trump," and took the Obama out of the headlines.
So again, you know, this headline, we already gave Syria to Putin, so what's left for Trump to say? You know, it's colonial language. You know, it's old style. But here's what the New York Times wrote just a couple of days ago, talking about reverting to colonial language. Quote, "Trump has signaled his desire to withdraw American troops from Syria, a move that would leave the country more firmly in the hands of President Bashar al-Assad."
You mean it's democratically elected leader?
Well, even if it's not democratically elected, it's Syria.
Right.
It's a Syrian government. the New York Times can actually talk about if Americans leave, if Trump takes Americans out, this will leave Syria firmly in the hands of Syria.
Imagine. Imagine.
I read every article on the subject very carefully. And I think in the last several years, I have seen exactly one article in the mainstream media which even mentioned the question of legality of U.S. presence of U.S. troops in Syria. It's just astonishing, really.
Well, it's just assumed that we'll be there. We're everywhere else. This is just our, you know, presumed stance is having military forces somewhere else.
Steve, Pat, we're out of time. I mean, I would have liked to have talked about the headlines around Mike Pompeo's trip to North Korea. But, you know, the media is so hostile to this trip. The headline, North Korea working to conceal key aspects of its nuclear program, U.S. officials say. That's on the eve of the trip. You know what? I think, John, America is actually revealing all of its nuclear secrets every day. And the whole rest of the world is so happy that the United States is so transparent about its nuclear weapons program, as are all nuclear powers.
Right.
Really?
Yeah, they're concealing something about their nuclear plan.
Imagine that.
Anyway, Steve, Pat, we are completely out of time. Thank you for not explaining any jokes to us this week.
Let me just remind listeners that all of these headlines, links to all these headlines and a lot of the ones we didn't have time to get to, will be found on my blog later today.
And what is the blog?
The blog is Left Eye on the News, which is lefti.blogspot.com.
All right.
That was the voice of Steve Pat. He joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are totally out of time now. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us here at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.